This is AWLS, podcasts on wilderness medicine from the University of Utah School of Medicine.
Hi, this is Richard Ingebretson from the University of Utah School of Medicine. Today, we're going to talk about common climbing injuries. So rock climbing has been around for a very, very long time. There are paintings from thousands of years ago showing Chinese men rock climbing. But more recently, they have discovered that climbing is a lot older than that. There's evidence that it's been around for inhabitants of this planet millions of years ago, when the very primate ancestors of we Homo sapiens put their hands up on the rock and climbed vertically up into the air. Everything from storing food to defense and hunting. But it was thought that rock climbing, as we know now, more of a sport, started about 100 years ago in the late 1800s in Europe, and then quickly spread from Europe to around the world. And now it is a very, very distinct and very popular athletic activity. A lot of medical studies have been looking at rock climbers. And if you are a rock climber, or if you're going to treat rock climbing, then you need to know sort of some of the basic problems. If you are a rock climber, then you become familiar with the aches and pains, and you will already know a lot of things that we're going to talk about. A lot of injuries are traumatic, someone falling or bumping, and it could be either minor or rather severe, and people die rock climbing. But the most common injuries end up being the overload injuries of the tendons, joints, and the muscles. Now, one thing you need to know that belayers, the people who help rock climbers get up on there, can be injured also. The basic premise of rock climbing is that as climbers ascend their routes, they clip into these pieces of protection in the rock. This will help catch them if they fall. So if you go up every foot or every meter, the last piece of protection as a climber goes up, they will then fall 2 feet or 2 meters before the rope begins to slow them down. So climbing ropes are very dynamic and can stretch as far as up to 30% of their length as you try to slow their fall rather than just bring it to an abrupt stop. As you know, injuries typically happen not by going fast, but by stopping quickly. And the more abrupt a stop is in any situation, the more damage that can be done to the body. So when someone falls, stretching the rope or having a belayer extend the fall will help the climber from experiencing injuries. The actual gear itself is able to withstand a lot of forces. A lot of ropes are up to 20 kilonewtons, which is a lot greater than the fall will generate. So it's very difficult that a rope would snap. But belayers can get injured. Now, most of the rock climbing injury talk is about the climber itself, but the belayers are injured quite a bit also. One of the most common injuries that a belayer will get is being slammed into the wall when a climber falls. This happens if the belayer is too far from the wall, creating the sort of broad pendulum effect. And if a belayer doesn't let out the slack when a climber falls, they will be drawn into the cliff and they can be injured. In fact, many climbing injuries, such as sprained and broken ankles and arms, happen when this when that pendulum effect happens. Belayers can also be injured by falling rocks as well. Falling climbers have hit belayers. There are many cases where climbers have become stranded on the cliff when the belayer is injured or killed even by falling debris. Another common injury that happens to climbers is if they pass their leg in front of the rope and then will fall. The rope grabs or wraps around the leg and flips them upside down, causing them to hit their head or injure their neck when they impact the rock. This can cause very severe spinal trauma and concussions. is one reason why helmets are worn while climbing to reduce the impact from these particularly dangerous falls. However, in all of climbing, the most dangerous moment for a climber is not while ascending, but the transition to descending. At the top of a route, a climber will build anchors to protect themselves, and when done with a climb, they will remove this protection, and momentarily they will shift from one safety system to another. Sadly, mistakes have been made at this very critical moment when climbers are thinking that they are secured to the second system, but they're not, and fall the full length of the route. This is one of the most common mistakes that results in climbing deaths. But many injuries that happen to climbers are not traumatic in nature and not related to the forces of falling. These are the constant and never-ending extreme forces that are put on the small tendons and ligaments of the hands and shoulders and wrists and other joints. The blood vessels and feet experience these. And if you're going to talk about injuries to a rock climber, you really need to talk about the hands, because the hands are where the rock climber really feels forces and damage and injuries. The tendons of the hands are what move the fingers from the muscles that are up in the arms. And in order for the tendons to work, they have to be held tightly to the fingers by a series of pulleys or straps. And the straps don't wrap all the way around the fingers to hold the tendons in. They wrap partway around and are kind of glued to the fingers. If you want to see a visual image of this or think of one, you can think of a fishing rod that has the the line going through the little eyelets. And this is sort of how the tendons work in the hands. And they number these pulleys 1 through 5. They're called A1, A2, A3, A4, and A5. And it turns out that the A2 pulley, which is a little more close, and the A3 pulley are the ones that tend to be injured the very, very most. If you read most literature, most talk about which pulleys are injured, it's the A2. But lately, a lot of data has been pointing to the A3 pulley. Now, we talk about joints of the hand as being distal, meaning far away, or proximal. And one common injury that happens in climbers is what they call a crimp grip. And this is where the climber will extend the DIP joint while flexing the PIP joint. In other words, they just grab the rock and they put their thumb around to hold on. Enormous forces are then put on the A2 and the A3 pulley at this time, even the A4 pulley. The A2 pulley will get up to 31.5 times the force they normally get. The A4 pulley will get up to almost 4 times that much. And so it's the crimp grip, or this grabbing of the rock, which will then cause a lot of the problems. So these are the pulleys that are most damaged. It usually happens, the crimp grip usually causes problems in when one or two things happens. One is when a climber loads the pulley past the threshold that they're able to withstand, one during a dynamic movement off of a crimp grip when they're reaching or stretching. And then another one that can cause increased loading is accidental, when a foot slips or a rock will break, and then they're holding on with the crimp grip, and the loading on those pulleys is just more than they can withstand. And when trauma happens to these pulleys, it can be significant or it can be minor. And that then becomes in the field when you're with a climber or you are a climber, then you're going to have to make some judgment as to what to do. The prevention and the treatment are almost kind of the same, and that is the best treatment is prevention. So gentle climbing and good technique and avoiding overloading the tendon pulleys is really the best way to avoid problems. These include exercises such as tendon glides to increase mobility. There's a lot of finger exercises that use elastic adjunct methods such as rubber bands to strengthen the tendons themselves. But the techniques really are very important. Climbers should focus on using their feet to make upward progress instead of pulling hard with their hands. Now, this is something that is taught in climbing, but it's more than just a technique. It really is a health issue. And climbers need to make a conscious effort to use the fulcrum grip less often when possible and try to use their feet more. Now, if you a climber has damaged a pulley, then you really need to make a diagnosis. It's sometimes going to be very hard in the field to do this. Usually it's recommended that you get an ultrasound if the pain is significant or if it's interfering with climbing. Pulley injuries are usually divided into grades, grade 1, grade 2, grade 3, and grade 4. The grade 1 pulley sprains are considered to be like a partial tear of a single pulley. There is no need for immobilization. Gentle range of motion exercises, bending the fingers till it feels tight and holding it and then relaxing and repeating these will usually allow the climber to get back rather quickly. And you can continue to do that until the patient or you feel comfortable climbing. But a grade 2 is where you have a complete A4 or partial A2 or A3 tear or rupture. You usually have to mobilize the fingers at that time for a couple of weeks to let them get better. And then you start gentle range of motion exercises. There are some techniques like H-taping for 3 months while climbing after you're able to climb again with the grade 2 injuries. It's impossible really in the field to tell which if you have a grade 1 or grade 2. You really might need an ultrasound. Unless you've had some experience, then you know that if it is just a grade 1. The grade 3 or where the A2 or A3 pulleys are completely torn, you're going to need to immobilize those with splints or pulley protection splints that you can buy online. Gentle range of motion exercises, H-taping, you might need for 6 months. There are some studies that have recommended surgical repair for grade 3. If you have a grade 4, this is an annual pulley rupture. There's nothing you can do to let these heal on their own. You're really going to need surgical repair for these, and then they're going to have to go through a lot of range of motion and recovery if that happens. But again, the way to prevent pulley injuries and to treat pulley injuries is really prevention. And to know about the crimp grip and the stresses that are placed on pulleys and don't let them happen. But it is not always just the hand pulleys and hand tendons that get into trouble with climbers. An interesting fact is that the muscles that control the hand and hence the crimp grip and the use of the fingers are further up in the arm. So a series of tendons go through the forearm, starting at the muscles to operate the fingers. There are two flexor tendon systems that are most often injured. The first is called the flexor digitorum profundus, and the second is the flexor digitorum superficialis. Both of these originate up near the elbow and then extend from the forearm muscles down to the fingers. The flexor digitorum profundus is different in that it ends at the far end of the fingers, while the flexor digitorum superficialis ends at the middle of the fingers. What this means is that the profundus is used more in climbing holds since it travels near to the tips of the fingers. They all run within a sheath which is designed to reduce friction as they move back and forth. And the sheath then become inflamed and cause a tendonitis. Flexor tendon injuries happen in sort of three ways. The first is when excessive strength is placed on the tendon itself, and the profundus is a more common injury because of the fact that it does all the way to the fingertips and can be injured in the crimp grip. the superficialis tendon is not under as much stress when in that position. So when the strength of a tendon is exceeded, it can lead to injury or even rupture. This most often when a climber accidentally falls or increases the load on a tendon when they're in that grip. Overuse is the second most common way flexor tendon injuries happen, and this can lead to a chronic tendonitis. Another common way to injure these tendons is an interesting way, and that is if a climber's fingers were in a pocket, or say they were jammed in a crack, and then while their fingers are in there, their foot slipped and their fingers were stuck in the rock, essentially hanging their body weight from these tendons. This is something that climbers should be trained for. But for as far as these tendons go, these weak tendons are really susceptible to injury from exceeding their strength. It is an important preventive measure to train tendons and muscles appropriately. So strong shoulder and upper arm muscles will help prevent overuse of these very, very important tendons. You can use low weight with high repetition shoulder exercises, such as with an exercise band, can be very useful on this. It's important to have good balance of training strength while also stretching the tendons during training. So rock climbing has been around for a very, very long time. There are paintings from thousands of years ago showing Chinese men rock climbing. But more recently, they have discovered that climbing is a lot older than that. There's evidence that it's been around for inhabitants of this planet millions of years ago, when the very primate ancestors of we Homo sapiens put their hands up on the rock and climbed vertically up into the air. Everything from storing food to defense and hunting. So it really sort of became a European rock climbing event. The treatment of tendonitis or injury to these is usually a conservative range of motion exercises for the tendons. Of course, resting them while they recover is important. The exercising the profundus should be full extension of the fingers and wrist with the elbows at 90 degrees. For the superficialis, it's the same, but with the elbow in full extension. Finger rolls can help also. But as we go up from the fingers to the arms, now we've got to go to shoulder injuries, because these are very, very common. A subluxation of the shoulder is a problem. Usually this is done a climber who is bouldering or who makes large overhead moves and makes these shoulders very susceptible to subluxation. What that means is a partial dislocation of the shoulder. It really happens as a result of extending the shoulder's ball joint too far forward. Usually people feel a sharp pain in the back of the shoulder and will need to stop climbing immediately. Continued movement at this point could result in a full dislocation. So recovery, if it's a dislocation, you have to reduce the shoulder. But recovery from a partial subluxation or a subluxation will require physical therapy and medical care. Stretching, conditioning, and strengthening will need what you do. But prevention is going to be the key to this. And make sure that you don't get into a situation where you're going to partially dislocate or sublux the shoulder. Yoga is really good for a lot of sports preparation, and it really is in with climbers on shoulders. Be sure to ease into difficult movements. Start on easy grades and then work your way up. Backing off if you start to feel any kind of discomfort in your shoulders. Warming up is good, but really sort of a no before you go onto the boulders or the cliffs is really important. Climbers are also high suspect for rotator cuff tears. It's a serious injury and something that you need to watch for. If a climber comes in with shoulder pain, this needs to be considered, as opposed to if you experience it. So as opposed to like a dislocation, it's possible to tear the muscles in the shoulder itself. This usually results pain and aching in the upper arm and shoulders when the arms are lifted above the head. That could signify a minor tear. Climbers may experience some weakness and some numbness in the upper arm going down into their arm. Again, prevention is the key to this. Stretching is a great way to kind of help prevent rotator cuff tears, but really getting those, keeping your shoulders in a way that they aren't subjected to those forces. And what's interesting is among primates, monkeys and are very good at stretching their arms way above their heads, but humans are not. And so putting our arms way above our head is just something that we're really not that good at. If you suspect a rotator cuff tear, they are not going to heal on their own usually. So after any injury, it's important to get an accurate diagnosis. You may not need surgery, and you may be able to strengthen the other muscles, but this is something that needs to be considered. That is surgery for a rotator cuff tear. We always talk about the arms, the fingers, shoulders, hands, but the foot is a really common injury with climbers, so you really need to go down low and start talking about that. And in fact, recent studies have shown that foot and ankle pathology account for up to 86% of rock climber injuries. So these can be overuse injuries. The degree of rock climbing and competitive rock climbing can increase the number of foot injuries. And then another one, and rock climbers will know this, they like to wear small shoes. This gives them a greater grip on the hill, mountain and on the cliff. But wearing small shoes is very hard on the feet. Rock climbing shoes are usually made of leather uppers and rubber toe and heel caps. The rubber of climbing shoes is specially formulated to stick to rock features and improve friction. It's very important. And depending upon the individual performance, as well as climbing difficulty level, athletes wear climbing shoes that are snugged to extremely, extremely tight. They typically wear shoes that are several sizes smaller than they wear in their street shoes. Climbing shoes have variable features to improve performance on a different terrain, and these features include downturned toes for overhanging rock and stiff toe boxes for specific crack climbing. While these are really good for performance, they contribute to many of the acute and chronic climbing-related injuries. And amongst those are the toenail injuries. Climbers need to make sure that their toenails are trimmed, otherwise they're going to get blood blisters, or what are called subungual hematomas, under their toes. They can also get tough fractures. That is, tiny fractures at the tip of their toes from swinging into their foot into the rock wall. If there is a bleed under a toenail, those can be drained on site, usually with a needle or a drill, or you can buy burning instruments that you can actually get the blood out of the toe, and that will relieve the pain. That will allow the rock climber to keep the nail and will allow the rock climber to continue to climb. If you get a tough fracture in from slamming a rock into the rock wall, then you're going to have to change the shoe so the climber can actually continue to climb. Another important injury that results as the tight-fitting shoes is basically what we're going to call as a bunion. It's called hallux valgus, and this is at the base of the great toe. And you get these gradual degenerative changes there because of the shoe that they wear. This is a biomechanical alteration of the foot as the shortening and contracture of those tendons. This is something that needs to be watched. This is a problem in people who climb a great deal. Another common injury is what's called the Lisfranc injury. The Lisfranc injury is often seen in football and soccer, but rock climbers are at a much increased risk for this. This is the ligaments in the middle part of the foot. And if this can happen with an abrupt injury, or it can be over a chronic. So you don't want to miss a Lisfranc injury in rock climbers. And the last injury you want to mention is a suspension trauma. Blood can pool in the legs of a climber if they are suspended in a vertical or sitting position for too long a period. Blood will pool in the legs. It is really essential that the muscle and the leg contract to squeeze blood back up to the heart and up to the brain. If it pools there for too long, people become lightheaded and can actually faint while they're on the rock wall. And this is a very serious condition, especially if they're high on the wall and are alone and being belayed because of the fact that they're just sitting or hanging in a position. Climbers should not be in this position for very long. And the other problem that happens is if they do get in this position, then the blood pooling can be in their legs, and then some of the metabolic byproducts that occur in the legs when you get the climber down can then travel to the kidney and cause kidney damage. So if a climber does pass out or has feelings of lightheadedness or dizziness, hot flashes, or a change in their heart rate, increased sweating, these are all signs that they're getting suspension trauma and need to come down quickly. And then you just need to make sure that those people are taken to a hospital or evaluated for these suspension trauma problems. There are a lot of injuries that happen to rock climbers that are typical, like hypothermia and hyperthermia and frostbite and ice climbing and things that we didn't cover in environmental issues. But these are things that you also need to watch out for. Make sure that if you are the medical person that is involved in rock climbing, or that if you are a medical person and you are rock climbing, or if you're just a rock climber, that you're aware of the potential problems. And prevention is always the key to any outdoor injuries, especially in this case. This ends the podcast on rock climbing. And as always, we thank you for listening.